Hi, hello. We have a fun episode of the Dunker Spot coming your way. It's Friday, so we are deep diving. We're talking about the Detroit Pistons. Kuka Hill of Locked On Pistons joins us to discuss Cade Cunningham's growth, Jalen Duren's growth areas, what is happening with Ausar Thompson's offensive usage, and is he the best perimeter defender in the league? All of that and more. From there, I wanted to talk about Paolo Banchero and the polarizing nature of how people discuss him. So Steve and I talk about that. And then we flow into an arrival talk. I revealed the rest of my official awards ballot and throw in some fake awards towards the end. Steve and I have a nice back and forth there. We hope you enjoyed it. And before you dig into the episode, just want to note we have some new content on the channel. The Dunker Spot Film Room is live. We talked about the Cleveland Cavaliers defense against the New York Knicks earlier this week. The hashtag is Dunk Tape right now, but you got the weekend. If you have another name for the Dunker Spot Film Breakdowns, toss them in the YouTube comments, shoot us an email, dunkerspot@yahoo.com, whatever you need to do. But we are going to have more of that content coming your way, and we hope you enjoy this episode. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of the Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I'm your host, Nikias Duncan. And joining me, as always, is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve, happy Friday. How are you?
What it do?
Okay, we got the quick intro from Steve, which normally means we have a guest, and we do have a guest in the building. We have Kuka Hill of Locked On Pistons here joining the show for the first time. Kuka, how are you?
I'm doing good. Happy to be here. I listen to you guys all the time. I love all your guys' work, so I'm happy to be here.
Oh, we're glad to have you. We are here to talk about the Detroit Pistons because this has been a phenomenal basketball team. As of recording, they have the best win percentage in the NBA right now, naturally the one seed in the Eastern Conference right now. Second best defense in the league. They have the best defense in the league in the calendar year of 2026. So I guess just on a broader sense, what has it been like for you, Kuka, covering this team? What were your expectations heading into the year, and how's that kind of compared to what they've been so far this year?
Yeah, I mean, they've blown by, I think, anybody's expectation. You take the most positive Pistons fan out there, I don't think even they would have predicted that in February 27th they would have the best win percentage in basketball, especially after the first month and a half of the season where there was a lot of conversation of would OKC break the win record. And now we're fast forward a few months and Detroit has a better record than them. Obviously, they beat OKC the other night without majority of their guys. But even just despite that, this has been a great year. A lot of improvement from a lot of the young guys. Cade's taking another step. Jalen Duren's really improved. No one really saw this coming before even Trajan Langdon, the GM of the team, never saw that. This is the second straight year he's made the comments of, I didn't expect us to be this good. I mean, he did the same thing last year. He did it again this year. So they keep passing everyone's expectations. I believe before the year, they're like 43.5 over under, and they're going to just fly by that. So it's been a crazy good year. This is way better than the past years than I had to cover the team, especially I'd rather begin the call from the Dunker Spot. Like, let's talk good basketball instead of getting call from random shows in Europe saying, how is it possible a team loses 28 in a row? I like this better. So it's been a better season.
It's gotta be a better setup. And I guess I'd ask this question, just kind of tap it on the expectations, because we talked about Detroit and you kind of felt the buildup coming. You saw them kept doing it every single night. Was there a moment for you where you're like, hey, this is kind of a special group. This is a special team. This is different than, you know, not just expectations, but this is something that can really stick at the top of the East and the top of the league?
I think it was the Wizards game where Cade missed like 31 shots. Like, I think he broke the record since Kobe or whatever for most missed shots in the game and like 30 plus attempts or whatever. That game right there, they were missing so many guys. And despite Cade shooting horribly in that game, he made multiple defensive plays and impactful plays at the other end of the floor. This was earlier in the year. And with a lot of guys out, you had Danish Jenkins step up, who at the time wasn't on the roster officially. He was a two-way guy. You had Chaz Lanier coming in and playing hard. Like, that's a second-round pick. Like, you had all these random players that before the year were just considered nothing more than that, just random players. Like Javonte Green, when he was signed in the offseason, was more so thought of as just like roster filler. And it was, you know, is he really going to be like that big of a deal? And I feel like that Wizards game, when you were without Jalen Duren, you were without quite a bit of your guys, and it was just really Cade and all these dudes. And I know they're the Wizards, and they ended up going to overtime to have to beat them. But the fact that you got Danish Jenkins hitting game-tying threes as the buzzer goes off, you got him going back and forth to C.J. McCollum, you got Javonte Green making crazy plays, dunking the ball, and then smacking the backboard, screaming at the fans. Like, it's at that moment, it was when it was like, okay, these guys are showing a different type of energy, a different type of level, not just from the top, but like from the top down. And they were all kind of taking on the persona of not just the city and the organization's history, but their head coach. So I feel like that game was the first time when I was like, okay, this might be a pretty deep team here.
Boom. And cool. I'm glad you said that, because I feel like the one thing that has stood out, and I'm swinging the ball right back to you, Nikias, has been the identity of this Pistons team. And during the streak that they had where they were winning games, obviously they had a really good record, but guys were in and out of the lineup and it didn't matter. Like, they just kind of had everyone step up, next man up mentality, and just everyone's a dog out there. Like, I remember early in the season, I was like, okay, they don't necessarily have some of the shooting they had last year, which was a big emphasis point, but they've replaced that with just dog mentality. So we're just going to have subs that are dogs and compete. And now it's Cade with three people that are out there dogging you out. And now they're physical and touching you and getting stops and running on the other end. And they do it every night. Like, that's the thing about Detroit. Every single night, hey, it may not be a perfect world for us offensively. We saw that in the San Antonio game. But hey, we're going to put paws on you. We're going to get stops. We're going to run. We're going to compete. You're going to have to earn this. I think the identity of this team has really helped lead them through this stretch and help them go to the top. Go ahead, Nikias.
Oh, no, I was just going to ask on that front, because you mentioned, like, this is back-to-back years where the expectation from the front office is like, we're going to be competitive. I didn't think we were going to be all of this. And this kind of coincides with this being year two under J.B. Bickerstaff now. And so I wanted to kind of frame it to just, what were your expectations of J.B. heading into his Pistons tenure? How have you kind of seen him grow with this team over the past couple of seasons?
Yeah, so when they hired J.B. Bickerstaff, you have to, like, kind of think about the time of when they hired him. There was a lot, I know a lot of people may not know this, but there was a lot of drama going on in the Pistons organization when they decided to hire J.B. Bickerstaff. There's obviously Monty Williams situation going on. There was talks about whether they would just keep him for a year and then let him go midseason instead of having to rush Trajan, because they hired Trajan late into the offseason. So, and he had to hurry up with his draft stuff. Like, it was, he felt really rushed. So there was a lot of talk of maybe he may just keep Monty for the season and then kind of address it later on. There's a lot of stuff that went on that ended up forcing their hand. So they move on and JB gets fired from Cleveland, kind of works out the perfect timing. So they're able to go and get JB Bickerstaff. And at that time, I feel like a lot of the expectation from a lot of us here in the community was just simply, will JB connect with the team, want to be here with the team, want to coach this team, and just get them to play hard night to night. I think those were some of the biggest complaints from this community over the last few years before J.B. Bickerstaff, just simply wanting to be here and wanting to get these guys to play as hard as possible. And that's by far, in a way, Steve, you mentioned it, number one takeaway from J.B. Bickerstaff and his time with Detroit. You can talk about his defense. You can talk about maybe some complaints creativity-wise, offensively. You can talk about how hard he is on the guys. Like, number one thing, how hard he gets them to play every single night. I mean, guys who aren't great defenders, who are never known as good defenders, like, have their best, it felt like, at least to me, their best defensive seasons with the Pistons. Like, Malik Beasley is not a good defender, but he tried with the Pistons almost every night. He tried as hard as possible. THJ wasn't a good defender, but he tried every night, taking charges, diving on the floor for the Pistons. I mean, Tobias Harris has spent a whole playoff series last year guarding Karl-Anthony Towns because JB challenged them, and he did a pretty good job of doing it. So, like, you keep going down, Duncan Robinson, like, just keep going down. He's maximizing the guys defensively that have, like, the measurables to make stuff happen. But even the guys who aren't good defenders, he's getting the absolute most out of them whichever way possible. So I think that's by far and away the number one takeaway from JB is how hard he gets them to play on the defensive end of the floor.
And to your point, the defense has been the hallmark of this group. Go ahead, Steve.
Well, I was going to say, I'm sure you had another question, but I think just the buy-in that he's gotten from this team, it ties in with that identity. The ability, as you said, to get them to play hard every single night and to just kind of get them to, you know, the best moments for a team is when not only are you a reflection of the coach, but the players take ownership. And I think that's one of the things you heard early in the season, quotes from Cade, quotes from Jalen Duren, as far as, hey, this isn't exactly where we want to be. We have more work to do. And that's kind of the hallmark of a team that buys into what their coach wants and understands. And now if the roster is echoing that to each other, then you've really got something special cooking. So I think that's one of those things where it's like, I think J.B. Bickerstaff gets underrated. The offense is what it is, but there's movement there. Well, you know, they don't have the most shooters to space the floor, but they find ways to go to empty side pick and roll and get handoffs and get flow going. But it's hard to get guys to do this every single night. I think that's where people really got to recognize what J.B. Bickerstaff has done in Detroit.
Yeah, I think even to that end, Steve, like we were talking about the Pistons early on last season, one of the things we both kind of noted, just looking at what the half court offense was, like, hey, this feels like a lot more like middle flashes for Jalen Duren, you know, than the second half of the possession. Like, let's get to the second side of actions. Let's just keep the ball moving. And like, even with some of the questions you may have about the Pistons half court offense, and we're certainly going to get there with Kuh during this conversation, you can at least see like the process feels pretty sound for me. Like, this is a team that is willing to move the ball. This is a team that is willing to cut. This is a team that is willing to screen hard, and they are willing to use multiple players and different player types as screeners to try to create advantages. So I think they are doing a good job within what the roster slash personnel context is. There's still upside there. And again, we'll get there a little bit later in the conversation, but I've enjoyed the JB experience. I think leaving Cleveland, like my thoughts, or I think he is a good coach. I think he helps you set a baseline. And who mentioned kind of the creativity portion, like, okay, what is that part going to look like if you're trying to get to the top tier? But from where the Pistons were when he was hired, you know, they're coming off the massive losing streak. Like, we need to establish a foundation. And so that he was able to do so as quickly as he did, as seamlessly as he did, to immediately turn Detroit into a playoff team. And now they are this 43-14 as of recording with obvious upside is incredible. It speaks to what he's been able to do, speaks to the vision that Trajan had, speaks to what these players are doing and how they're buying into both of your points. So like, I've been super impressed with what this has looked like so far. But Kuh, you mentioned Cade Cunningham in the middle of this. He has been pretty easily Detroit's best player this year. Feels like a firm MVP candidate right now. And that's before we get into any of the games played stuff, whatever. Cade has been fantastic. As of recording, 25.4 points, 51% on twos, 34% on threes, which knocking down all these pull-ups and missing all these catch-and-shoot threes, I don't know what to do with the weird split this year. But either way, that's where he is with threes. 81% for the line, getting to the line more this year. 6 boards, 10 assists, a steal and a half, a block. What has been the most impressive part of the Cade Cunningham experience to you?
The split between the catch and shooting pull-up. I had it written down here. It's been one of the weirdest things all year because Cade has been a really good catch and shoot three-point shooter throughout his career. So the one year he finally adds the pull-up three-point shot, he just forgets how to catch and shoot. It's just crazy. I think one of there's two things with Cade. There's a lot of things that Cade's done. I'm sure we'll talk about it. But if I just had to pick like my top two biggest takeaways from Cade that's impressed me this year, I'll go one on the offensive end and one on the defensive end. Offensively, what he's doing, last year he turned the ball over way too much. High usage guys are going to turn the basketball over. It's part of what comes with it. But he was crossing the line way too much, especially in the playoff series against the New York Knicks. It was something he had dealt with. This year, the turnovers still are high, but that comes with a guy who's going to have the ball in his hands a lot more. But he's really done a great job of cutting them down. So, like his scoring turnover percentage, last year he was 8.4%. That was the 14th percentile. This year, he's cut it down by 2.1%. Now he's in the 50th percentile. When it comes to turnovers, his turnover percentage in pick and rolls, last year he was 15.9%. This year, he's 14.9%. Last year in transition, turnover percentage. This was probably one of the biggest issues last year for the Pistons, that they love to run. They want to get out in transition, but a lot of times they would turn the ball over still. Cade didn't have the strongest of handles last year. Last year, he had a 17.4% turnover percentage in transition. This year, it's cut down to 15%. In isolation, he was at 10.3 turnover percentage. This year, now he's at 8.3. So he's cut down the turnovers in every single situation possible. He's become a much smarter basketball player on the offensive end of the floor. And does he turn the ball over a little bit too much sometimes? Sure. But like Luka does too. LeBron, like all these high usage guys are going to have games where they just lose it sometimes. Like it comes with it. But on the whole of the season, he's become such a better like maestro of the offense, like the orchestrator of the offense. It feels like he's mastering it before everyone's eyes all year. So that's by far the biggest takeaway I have, especially with what I think we're going to talk about coming up. And then secondly, defensively, he's averaging a block on the season. Name me the point guards, superstar starting point guards that are averaging a block on the season. He's become one of the best weak side rim protecting guards in the league. It's him, Derek White, depending on what you call the Thompson twins, guards, wings, whatever. He's one of the best out there. He makes crazy plays at the rim. He's active in the passing lanes. I think that this is by far the most consistent season. Cade's always had defensive capabilities to be like a real impactful defender. This year, it started last year a little bit more, but this year by far is the most consistent he's been on that end of consistently making plays on the defensive end. A lot of people consider playmakers offensively. Pistons have a bunch of playmakers defensively, and he's one of them. And it leads to plays like this, and it leads to them getting easy offense. So those are the two biggest takeaways I have from Cade this year.
I like it. Like, I think for me, like you mentioned kind of the playmaking, the turnovers cutting down, like looking at the basic box score, that was the thing that jumped out to me most. So I was kind of just typing things into the doc. Cause like, you know what the baseline numbers are. It's going to be 25. It's going to be 5 or 6 rebounds. He's been among the league leaders in assists all year long. Seeing the turnovers go from like 4.5 last year to a little under 4 this year is like, hey, it's not easy to have that level of responsibility and to cut your turnovers down. And as we all have these conversations about what the offensive context is for Cade Cunningham, which I think also factored into why the turnovers have generally been high for him throughout his career, the fact that it has gotten better, but it's still not where you ultimately want it to be, and he still managed to take the turnovers down, that part's been impressive. You look at how defenses are treating him, he is seeing pretty much every coverage in the book. He'll get dropped, he'll get late switches, he'll get hedges, he'll get traps. He's seeing a pretty high percentage of double teams this year. You know, he's seen a whole lot of help on his drives this year, still one of the highest marks in the league among high volume drivers. And that coming down has been super impressive. And I think it speaks to something that stood out to Cade early on, if you watched him in college or before then, or even early in his NBA career. Like, there is just a cadence and a patience that he attempts to play with. It's hard to speed him up. And to your mastery point, it feels like he's finally hitting that rhythm where, like, not only are you not going to speed me up, I can go slower if I want to and still get to the spots that I want to. There's another level of manipulation that's kind of come with him when he's initiating ball screens or just in general getting downhill that I've really enjoyed. And to the defense point, I've enjoyed the effort. I've enjoyed the weak side defense. Like, and this is where I was in Los Angeles for All-Star stuff. And J.B. Bickerstaff was talking about the defense, was talking about Cade. And he's very intentional about noting, like, yeah, we have this defense. Cade is a part of this defense. Like, he is a part of why we are as good defensively. The fact that you get that kind of engagement from your star, first and foremost, makes it easier for everyone else to fall in line when you see your top guy playing hard. And the fact that he is also adding legitimate impact, I was pulling up like his EPM numbers this year, career high in terms of defensive EPM, if you care about that particular stat. He was positive last year, to your point about it starting last year. These are the first two times in his career that he's been positive on that end. And so him turning into a legit two-way force versus high-octane offensive weapon that can play defense sometimes, I think it's a major shift for him and ultimately a major shift for the Pistons.
Well, I kind of want to go back, to the offensive points. I think both of you nailed it. I think his playmaking growth has been huge. I think one of the things about Cade is, like, he has the patience. He can make the reads, but he's got a burst this year. He's real, not just herky-jerky, but he's got just flashes of speed at times to set different things up, which I think has helped him kind of make these reads and say, okay, you're switching. I can turn the corner. I can read my space. I can do whatever I want. I think he's kind of not just operating within this context, but I can make these plays no matter what the coverage is. And when you arrive in that place as a young guard, especially with the kind of role that he has asked to be in Detroit, I think that's huge. And I was going to ask, Koo, like, how fascinating has it been to kind of see his full journey as not just like an offensive playmaker, but an offensive engine? Because a lot of this early was him being able to not just score, but make the right reads to make defenses pay.
We all know how, like, the quality of the teams that he was surrounded by for the first 2-3 years of his career. But very early, the Pistons put the ball in his hands a ton, and they asked a lot of him. And maybe there were some people at the time, they were like, hey, you're putting a little too much on his plate at this time. He's too young. He's not ready for all this. You're kind of hurting him. I feel like a lot of that, and I feel like that was kind of, from the outside point of view, kind of what Dallas was trying to do with Cooper Flagg a little bit at the beginning of the year, where it's like, hey, it may not look the greatest now, but this is going to help him in the long term. This is going to help him learn. He's going to get to a point where this ends up helping him down the line. And I think a lot of what Cade went through with, like you mentioned, seeing all these different coverages, dealing with double teams as early as, like, I don't know, second half of his rookie year, early second year. I know he got hurt that year, but even third, like, he's seen traps, blitzes, double teams for a very long time, to where now it feels like that he's kind of accustomed to it and he knows how to attack it. There's times I feel like the biggest weakness or the best way to attack the Pistons, and Cade specifically, is when you switch up coverages throughout the game. You give them a heavy dose of something, you switch it up on them, and it sometimes it takes him a minute, like he's not expecting it, and you'll catch him off guard and you'll get an easy turnover from him. I feel like that's the easiest way to kind of frustrate them a little bit at times. But if you give him a heavy dose or something, he's usually just picking it apart over and over and over again. And I think that has a lot to do with just a lot of the struggles and the willingness from the Pistons to allow him to just continue to go through the struggles, not change anything, not lose faith in him, not, you know, anything change that much. Just understand that this is what we want him to go through. This is what he needs to go through, and it will eventually pay off. And I think it has.
I'm right there with you. I guess on that point, especially with him getting two on the ball, one of the stats that I wanted to bring up with you and kind of ask a question tied to that, among 77 players that have run at least 500 pick and rolls this year, Cade has been blitzed on around 11% of those. That is 10th among those 77 players. On those specific possessions, the Pistons are generating offense at a 0.8 points per possession clip. That is well below what the league average is right now. And I think something that stood out in the Spurs game, one, you had Victor Wembanyama just roaming off of various people that he was not worried about from the perimeter. So that's a broader picture thing. But like, they did also mix in a little bit of, oh, we're late in the clock, let's send an extra guy at Cade, let's see what he does. Let's mix in a little bit of aggression at the level sometimes to see what he does. Are you worried at all about, once Detroit gets to the playoffs, teams ramping up the pressure against him? Not necessarily that he can't handle it, but more so like, what are the others going to do when teams are trying to force the ball out of his hands?
Yeah, so this was interesting because at the very beginning of this year, at least it felt like to me, watching the games, it felt like at the very beginning of the year, teams were trapping him a ton. They were blitzing him a ton out of pick and rolls. They were trapping him a lot. And it felt like the first few weeks, the Pistons were repeatedly just killing teams within him. A lot of it had to do with Jalen Duren's aggressiveness as a scorer himself, not just looking for passes. If you're trapping Cade in the pick and roll and Duren's rolling, a lot of the times the guy's tagging down from the weak side is a much smaller defender than whoever's going to usually guard Jalen Duren. So to start the year, it felt like that Duren was really making teams pay repeatedly over and over and over again by just dunking over a smaller defender, finishing through a smaller defender. And it felt like after the first few weeks, teams kind of went away from just flat out blitzing him. It felt like watching, and they went to mixing up some coverages. And I feel like that started to give the Pistons half court offense a little bit more of an issue, to the point where I was on the podcast talking about, it feels like teams have outwardly said, we don't believe that if we don't consistently give the Pistons 4-and-3 situations, that they can beat us in the half court. If we consistently give Duren 4-and-3 situations and allow him to just attack a guard underneath the rim, that's going to hurt us. So it felt like for a minute there, that's what teams' plans were. But over the last month and a half or so, it feels like we're starting to see more blitzes again. We're starting to see more aggressiveness in the pick and roll. And I think one of the biggest things that is coming of this, or I think one of the best ways they can solve this or kind of make it a easier thing for them to attack is twofold. One, I think Duren needs to improve or get back to where he was as a passer last year. I think you're seeing a lot of his scoring improvements have been amazing, but I think teams are starting to play him for that scoring. Even when they trap Cade, they're sending multiple bodies to Duren, seeing if he'll beat them as a passer. And he's been so locked in as a scorer. Overwhelmingly, it's been a huge positive to where it's paid off more often than it hasn't. So you kind of live with it right now. But I feel like once the playoffs come around, that's one of the adjustments I'm sure the coaching staff will go over with Duren and be like, hey, got to kind of focus. They're playing you for this. We have some guys open on the weak side. You kind of look for this. That's one. Two, I think it kind of boils down to, like last year, you guys mentioned it, the Pistons had a little bit more shooting. So when teams would trap Cade, if he did hit Duren in the short roll, he had someone to kick it out to consistently, whether it's Asar cutting on the baseline or Malik Beasley and THJ kind of waiting for shots from beyond the arc. I don't feel like the Pistons have that level of shooting. I think everyone agrees with that. Tobias has not had a good shooting season. Duncan Robinson has been great, but it's really just all reliant on Duncan Robinson. So I feel like a lot of that comes from the lack of shooting around it. And also Duren just being so locked in as a scorer that he's not at times finding guys open, which again, like I said, it's been more of a positive than a negative. You live with it, and it's led to some really good stuff for him. But in the playoffs, I think that's an easy adjustment that the coaching staff can kind of hit on.
Well, I'm glad you nailed that. I think it was a back and forth meeting Nikias have had as well, as far as, okay, do you want to trap Cade Cunningham? Because you are now giving Detroit an advantage they did not have. So to watch teams kind of go back and forth has been interesting. I think to your Jalen Duren point, I know we're going to touch on him a little bit, but I think he did such a good job early of saying, I don't care if you're here on this short roll help, I'm going to finish through this. I'm going to mix in some passing. Then now you see so many teams are in early, as you mentioned, and saying, you know what, actually, we're not going to let you get all the way to the rim. We're not going to let you get this roll. We're not even going to let you get to the pocket. And so Detroit having worked through that has been interesting. But again, they have such a mix where it's like, okay, we're going empty side, but we're rolling Durant to the empty side. We're keeping him away from the help defense. Now you have to make a decision this way. We're flowing to a handoff. There's so many different kind of actions where they can kind of poke at teams or at least try to generate an advantage that gets really tricky. Is there a team that you've seen where it's just, and it kind of ties to a question Nikias, I think, had about the Pistons overall. Is there a team that you've seen that's had just a coverage or an idea where it's like, ooh, little spooked by what this could look like if they nail this over the course of a series?
Does the Wemby coverage count? Like, can I just say Wemby in general?
That
like,
counts. That counts.
San Antonio. I mean, San Antonio by far gave them some of the biggest issues I've seen of the year. But they're so unique because of Wemby that it kind of feels like that. I don't know if other teams would be able to replicate quite what they did. Because again, just Wemby. I don't know if I can think of just another team, that singular team, that's really given them the most issues. Because I think they've, for the most part, done the best with what they can right now. Because of the lack of shooting, and because they live with, like you, I mean, I think that's a great point what you brought up, Steve, that they're meeting Durant much higher. Like Boston, I guess, I'll use this one. Boston has done a much better job in the matchups they've played after like maybe the first matchup of guarding Durant, and they do it with smaller guys. And it's going into the matchup, you think Durant should be able to just dominate them because they're not, at least until Kata started to play really well, but they had a lot of smaller lineups against the Pistons. And it was like, okay, Durant should just dominate. But what Boston was doing such a great job of, which I don't know, again, if this is something that a lot of teams have the personnel to do, but they would meet Durant high, like you're mentioning, in the short roll. And then when he catch the ball, they're sending a lot of smaller bodies, but they're constantly swiping down at him. He's putting the ball down. He's bringing the ball low, and they're constantly swiping down to where he's losing the ball. He's finding himself in traffic, and it would lead to turnovers. It would lead to bad offense. So now that I'm thinking about Boston is the one I would immediately think of, even though the Pistons have won, I think, 3 of the 4 matchups. They ended up winning, but Boston was able to utilize a matchup to where they kind of – or utilize a scheme in which they were able to do something that was a little bit of a issue for the Pistons. I don't know if many teams can kind of replicate with as many, you know, Joe Mazzulla is great, so I don't know if many teams will be able to do it, but Boston's one of the ones that come to mind. And obviously, like, Wemby was, like, I was in person for that game. I have never – he could have shot 0 of 500 in that game, and he would have been the most viable player on the floor. It was crazy seeing it in person. It was absolutely insane.
I love that you and Steve now within the calendar week have been like, hey, so if you haven't seen Wemby in person, this is kind of insane. Like, TV does not do it justice. How good that guy is and how much space he takes away. He's insane. I will say very quickly before we transition, I was looking at some of the half court numbers for the Pistons in some of their games this year. You mentioned Boston, 3-1 against Boston. Only one of those 4 appearances have the Detroit Pistons logged a league average or better half-court offense in across those 4 games. The teams I wanted to bring up that coincidentally they are playing, the Pistons are playing later tonight, are the Cleveland Cavaliers. 0-2 against the Cavs so far this year. Sub-90 offensive rating in the half-court in both of those games. I would say that feels more like personnel-based because of the collective size they have in the front court more than like anything schematic. Or at least off rip, but I guess I'll toss that to you. How do you feel about a potential Cleveland matchup?
So one of the matchups against the Cavs was, I think, like the second game of the year or third game of the year, one of those two. And the Pistons got absolutely blitzed. They got absolutely destroyed. I remember when that game happened, there was a lot of, oh God, we're heading back. This is about to be the good year was fine. Now we're back to being the Piston. Like it was a lot of talk like that after that game. And then I think literally immediately after that game is when they went on that like 15-game win streak or whatever. So I'm interested to see these teams match up. since then. I want to see how, over more of a sample, how the games actually would look since then. Because the Pistons are a much better team and a different team than they were at the beginning of the year. So I don't know if it would go exactly like that now. It's disappointing that they're going to play Cleveland later tonight. And it sounds like we know Mitchell's out. And it sounds like James Harden may also be out. So that's one of the things I've really been disappointed with this week, is that the Pistons this week was supposed to be, and really next week as well, was supposed to be like these multiple tests of when you get to see, okay, how do they look against similar competition? What does it look like? What do they have to adjust to? What do they have to improve on? And OKC's had a lot of their guys, and it looks like Cleveland's going to be out a lot of their guys as well. So that's disappointing. But Cleveland is one. I said on the podcast last week, if you were looking at the rest of the Eastern Conference and you just asked me to pick the one team that could cause them the biggest problems, I went with Cleveland because of what you mentioned, the size of Evan Mobley and Jared Allen. I think that provides them a level of rim protection, obviously, and the ability to, I'm sure we're going to see this in the playoffs eventually. Like if they were to match up with Cleveland, I'm sure they put one of those guys on Asar and they probably just roam off of them. And then you'd have to figure out how to attack that. So they have two guys that are able to provide rim protection for the Pistons. And you know that the Pistons love to get to the paint. They want to score a ton. They want to dominate the glass. Would they be able to kind of flex their muscle on Cleveland like they would all these other teams? I think we'd have to wait and see to find out. I've watched the Pistons do that to just about every team they've played all year this year. So I hope and I believe they would be able to, but Cleveland offers a different type of size and physicality that not a lot of teams have. So I think that's the main issue the Pistons could run into against Cleveland. I think another issue that they could run against Cleveland as well is not just on, you know, with Cleveland's defense offensively, or the Pistons defense, but Cleveland offensively. I'm interested to see how they would guard the Cavs now with James Harden. Like, are you putting Asar on Harden because of how good he is as a screen navigator and try to just eliminate the pick and rolls and try to take away the lobs and dump offs to Jared Allen? I think Asar as of right now is like the 99th percentile in screen navigation. He's like, I think Asar is the best perimeter defender in the league. So I think you put him on Harden and then try to just eliminate the pick and rolls. And then you put Cade on Mitchell and kind of just say, if Mitchell beats us, he beats us. That's the coverage they've went against with Kawhi. Now, Kawhi did beat them. He scored like 57, so it is what it is. Boston, they've done it with Jaylen Brown, and he's had a great – I think he's averaging like 35 or something against the Pistons, but they've won three of the matchups. So all year, that's kind of been their coverage. I'm interested to see, though, would it stay that way, and would they play maybe more Ron Asar minutes to try and match those guys? Because not many teams have two dynamic guards like that. And the Pistons don't necessarily have multiple great defenders on the perimeter in their starting lineup. So I'm interested to see how that would play out as well.
Got you. Actually, so one quick correction on my front, on my part. Detroit 1-1 against Cleveland, not 0-2. So my apologies on that front. That was the game you were mentioning, 21-point loss on October 27th, very early in the year. There. And actually, I do kind of want to transition to Asar since you bring him up. One of the questions I was going to ask you is, like, where do you rank him among perimeter defenders right now? Because when watching this Detroit defense, I'm with Steve. The collective physicality that this team plays with can just be overwhelming for teams that aren't prepared for it. And even if they are prepared for it, they can still get beat down and bogged down. But watching Asar defensively has been an absolute joy. It has been since he entered the league, frankly. But he mirrors in space so well. You mentioned the screen navigation stat thing from B-Ball Index and what he's doing as a screen navigator. What he can do as a weak side rim protection. The fact that the Pistons have multiple guys in their starting lineup between Asar and Cade, that, oh, if we're the low man, like, we can blow stuff up. Like, Jalen Duren could play at the level, and we're not super worried about what the rim is going to look like because we have one or both of those guys in position to muck things up behind, is a luxury that not many teams have. But, oh, boy, you said Asar is the best perimeter defender in basketball. And, like, I don't have an inclination to be like, whoa, that's crazy. What about insert five names here? Like, I think he has, at the very least, earned his way into that discussion. So, Steve, I guess I'll toss the question to you. Do you believe Asar is the best perimeter defender in basketball? And if not, like, who are you kind of considering in that range?
I mean, one of. I think it gets tricky because different guys are asked to do different things, right? So I think what Asar does really, really well with screen navigation and size is really, it's not easy to do. But is that better than someone who may be a little bit smaller who has to give a little bit different type of effort? So that in my brain is where I'm like, I don't know if I can get to the best perimeter defender right now, because ultimately, what does that mean? Because if he's that good, guess where I'm going to put him? Over in the corner, away from my best player. So what does that mean overall in the playoffs? how can I get away from him? How can I put Cade Cunningham and Duncan Robinson in action? And so will you really feel that come playoff time? So, you know, where my coach brain goes, I'm like, yes, coach brain. But also, sure, go over there.
For what it's worth, the Clippers did exactly what you're talking about. Like in the two matchups they played against, and Boston for what it's worth as well, like they put Asar on Harden, and then Harden was just standing in the corner for a lot of the game, and it was just Kawhi kind of just running the action. And then against Boston, they put Asar on Pritchard, and they were just like, okay, fine, we'll put Pritchard in the corner, and we'll just run actions away from Asar. And I think that was one of the more frustrating points amongst the Pistons community, because during the games, while Brown and Kawhi are going off, it's like, okay, just switch the matchup, put Asar on these guys. Like, just let him try to guard him and take him away. And instead, they were just like, no, we don't want to give up dribble penetration. We don't want to give up driving kicks for threes, which is why the Pistons defend the three so well. We don't want to give that up. If the guys want to go one-on-one and beat us that way, we don't think it's going to happen consistently. We're sticking with what we're doing. So I think that, I mean, we've already seen teams do that. What you've mentioned, they stay away from them, just like, hey, go over there. We just won't involve you. It is what it is.
I think there's this like level of reverence you get to as a perimeter defender. Like, it's funny we bring up the Kawhi example. Like, Kawhi got that a lot early on after kind of earning his way as like a DPOY level guy. It's like, hey, what if we just stashed you in the corner? If you remember that Spurs year where it was just a huge conversation point among like the NBA Twitter community for like the first 2 months, it's like, wait, why do the Spurs have a better defensive rating with Kawhi off the floor? That's weird. He's so good. And you look at the film and it's like, oh, well, Kawhi's just not in action right now. Teams are playing 4-on-4 because they are terrified of that guy. But while we're on Asar, I want to flip to the offensive end, because that seems to be where a lot of the angst around Pistons fans and around Asar, around the Pistons offense overall is. Because as teams like the Spurs and others are getting more comfortable saying, we're just going to put a big on someone to take away the paint, that option in the starting lineup more often than not is Asar Thompson. And so just kind of broadly speaking, how have you felt about the way that he's been utilized offensively? How much of any of the concerns people have is Asar needs to be better at this versus I wish Asar was used in this way to mitigate some of the weaknesses?
Yeah, I think the Asar, I don't even want to call it an issue. The Asar topic offensively has probably been the most frustrating part of the Pistons season on for multiple reasons. We talked about a little bit earlier about how Trajan Langdon has come out and said, I didn't expect us to be this good twice. Like last year he said it, and then again this year. I think if like at the trade deadline, a lot of Pistons fans wanted them to go out and like make a move and try like go all in. And they did not do that. And the reason why I bring that up is it's not a disconnect. I'm not saying there's a disconnect. It's just that I think Trajan coming into the year, I know, wanted this to be more of a, he's not wanting to throw games away to develop, but he wanted this to be a season of, okay, let's see Asar with the ball in his hands more. Let's develop Asar. Let's see what we can do with him on the ball. The front office, I know for sure, I've talked with people, they are extremely high on him. And they wanted to come into this year like, hey, we want him on the ball. We want to see what he can do. But as the team started to win as much as they did, and as they continued to serve, it's like, hey, this isn't just a development year. This is, we're really taking this next step. It's become more JB saying, look, we can do that another time. There's other things that will help us win right now. And they've got so good to a point where everyone else is kind of just like, fair enough. It is what it is. So at the beginning of the year, Asar is used a little bit on the ball. Like the first 14 games of the year, I think he's averaging like 14, low turnover percentage. He was getting to the free throw line a ton. I think his free throw rate was like 39% or something. He was doing a good job. And the offense was better with him on the floor because of it. Since then, they've scaled him down a ton. They're using him off the ball in the corners a lot. And I feel like there's just a level of like, okay, what do you want from him? Like that's one of the questions that I'm really wanting to ask JB after one of these games I'm at. Maybe I might do it today. It's just like, okay, what's the role that the Pistons are like? Is there a defined role you guys want of Asar? Because it seems like that they don't really even know what they want him to be offensively right now. At the beginning of the year, it was, we want him to be our secondary creator. We want him to be our secondary ball handler, run some actions. You know, that's what they wanted him. And then as the season went on, he kind of just went to the corner and was just back to cutting along the baseline dunker spot. Then we started to see them play a little bit with him as the screener, as the DHOs, in the DHOs and stuff. And that it feels like they don't really know exactly how they want to use him. And I feel like that's contributed to a lot of the I guess, complaints about him offensively. Obviously, he has to improve. Like, he can't shoot. Like, he has to improve. And his handle, while it has gotten a lot better, needs to still get better to where maybe, JB maybe trust him a little bit more at a larger usage to run some actions. I think it's gotten a lot better, but maybe it hasn't gotten quite good enough in traffic to where JB maybe feels as comfortable doing it enough. But that's the disconnect, is that what is it that you want Asar to do offensively? What is his role? What is it you're asking of him to do? And can he thrive in that role? Because so far, it feels like throughout the year, it's been a lot of here. What is it? No one really knows. And the biggest concern amongst the business community is the option in the playoffs cannot be. I was really looking forward to hearing what Steve said about this, because a lot of us in the community feel like the option in the playoffs cannot be, or the answer in the playoffs to, okay, they put a big on Asar. The answer cannot be sit Asar. You cannot sit this guy on the bench. He's too impactful to what they do on both ends of the floor. He generates their best offense, which is turnovers, transition, fast breaks, second chance points. You can't just sit him. That can't be the answer. So what is the answer? What will you guys do? How are you guys going to counter this? And far too often at times this year, it has been just simply sit Asar, and it hasn't worked out when they've done it. So I think there's a lot of Asar needs to get better for sure. But also it's like, okay, what a lot of people trying to figure out what it is where do they want him to be at?
Yeah, I have one thought with Asar. I'll try to be quick with it. I think there's a beauty in the way that they've used him this season, as far as there's not been one thing he's been asked to do. That can be tough to swallow at times, because you want to see growth. You want it to be linear. But I think if you counter it with maybe like how Amen Thompson has been, well, he's just going to be on ball, and now you're looking at all the on ball stuff and you don't really notice anything else. It's like he used to cut, now he's just on ball and he's not. With Asar, he's kind of like a Swiss Army knife a little bit, in the way that, okay, he may be spaced in the corner, he's going to cut if defenses help off of him. He may be spaced on the wing, he's going to be ready to get a quick kick in transition and kind of stampede. He can be used as a screener. He can get a random handoff. He can kind of be used within the flow of what Detroit does, which I think is a little bit more important than, you know, okay, he consistently has to do this. So he can initiate, but, you know, his initiation isn't a tell that, okay, I have the ball in my hand, so I'm automatically going to run pick and roll. No, we might just be getting K'd off ball. He might just swing it to the wing real quick. Just kind of depends. So the fact that it's not as easy to just be like, well, Asar Thompson's doing this, or we're going to respond with that, helps him in a way. And it kind of fits into what Detroit does, because they are and can be a little bit. But there's no one area of the court where it's like, okay, I know Asar Thompson's going to be here every single time, and now I can set my help off to do this every single time. Yeah, you're going to put, you're going to treat him like a non-shooter. You're going to put a big on him. You know, you can use him as a screener, but he gets those quick outlets, and now he pushes, and that's kind of his way to kind of be a part of the offense and generate flow. So I think there's a beauty in his sandbox nature within the Detroit offense, as opposed to sometimes we can get so caught into, okay, young player needs to get better at X, Y, and Z. Why is he not doing that? Well, if we start just only doing that, guess who's going to notice? All these other teams. I'm going to pick it up on tape and be like, all right, well, they're doing this with the Asar. Go under. And now, okay, you run into a different issue. So I think it's a give and take. It's going to be something they're going to have to navigate in the playoffs, but I don't think it's the end of the world. I think he's getting enough reps to where you can kind of feel good about progress. Because how often has it truly, truly felt like, boy, we can't play him? They've chosen not to, but how many games has it really felt like, boy, he's not doing anything for us?
Right.
Yeah, I would imagine that number is, as I say, it's got to be under 5 for sure on that front. I have a couple of like quick hitter questions for you, Koo, before we transition and get to the break here. So one, circling back to Cade. Is he your MVP right now? Or if you had a ballot, where would you have him right now?
He is not my MVP right now. I'm not going to be too biased with that. I think it's easily going to be SGA as long as he hits 65 games. SGA is having a crazy year. I think if Jokic were to get the 65 games, he also would be ahead of him. I'd have Cade third or fourth. I have Wemby and Cade kind of alternating at 3 or 4. That's where I would have him.
Okay, got you. You mentioned the Spurs a little bit earlier as a team. We're like, ooh, I don't know how I feel about them against our offense. I guess among the West contenders, the Thunder, the Spurs, you want to get into the Rockets or the Wolves or anyone else, how many teams out West do you feel Detroit, or how many teams would you favor Detroit over in the West if they make the finals?
OKC I would have over Detroit. I can't sit here and say Detroit over San Antonio after they just lost. So I can't come on here and say that. So San Antonio over Detroit. Outside of that, I don't know. I think maybe Denver. Even they beat Denver both matchups they played, but they haven't had Aaron Gordon in a minute. So maybe that, I mean, obviously Aaron Gordon's really impactful with what they do. So I, for sure, I'll say OKC, probably San Antonio because they just beat them. And then maybe Denver because Denver has Jokic and AG hasn't been there. So those three teams, everyone else I feel pretty confident about.
Okay, I got you. I guess related to the Asar Thompson thing and him closing sometimes, sometimes not closing. What do you think the ideal closing lineup is for Detroit?
I think it's just their starting lineup. Their starting lineup has been so impactful. They've been dominant all year in their minutes. I think just Cade, Asar, Duncan, Tobias, and Duren is probably, I think, their best chance at having, I mean, the lineup's been good all year, but their best chance at having defensive versatility, impact on that end, while also just having just enough spacing offensively to try to make it work offensively. I think that's the lineup they should go with.
Okay, I got you. And last thing for me, how many bigs are better in the Eastern Conference than Jalen Duren?
Oof. Okay. Can I say not many? Can I say not many?
Oh. Like,
is that a bailout answer? I don't know. I'd say, man, that's. Would I rather have him? I think I'd rather have him over Kat now at this point. So, like, probably I'll say the best. I'll say he's the best in the East.
Okay.
Him, there actually, we counted Mobley as a center. Are we count like Mobley, like, I don't, like, he's up there, top two, three. Like, that's where he's at.
Okay. We'll let you rot with that. We'll let you rot. One last literal question, Koo. Where can the people find you? Where can they find your work?
You can find me over on Twitter at Kook Hill, or also you can find the Locked On Pistons podcast 5 days a week, whatever podcast platform you're listening to this on, or over on YouTube as well, at Locked On Pistons.
There we go. We appreciate you joining us, brother. We're going to keep close eyes on the Detroit Pistons. Certainly going to factor in heavily in the playoff picture once we get there. We're going to take a break right now. When we return, we're going to keep the conversation out east. I have a stream of consciousness thought that I want to talk through with Steve. So please stay tuned. Welcome back to this episode of The Dunker Spot. And Steve, I want to stick with the Eastern Conference. And I also want to broaden the scope at the same time. So talked about this a little bit earlier in the week offline, but I've been kind of simmering on a like most polarizing players type thought for a while. Just kind of building a list. And I was kind of going through players that have either had me in a headlock this year, watching or trying to evaluate them, or the conversation around these players have been so loud in both directions that it has given me a headache. And so I do, in typical Nikias fashion, I do have a pretty long list of guys that I'll eventually want to sort through with you, or maybe we do that with a guest. We'll see. As a tease, just know that the Heat, the Hawks, the Celtics, the Wolves are very well represented on this list. But today I want to talk about Paolo Banchero, Steve. And as we were talking about a little bit offline, it's not like we haven't talked about Paolo on the show before. I think he's a very loud case to me of a talented, physically overwhelming player that doesn't have like the advanced or the impact metrics to match. And so it kind of creates this dissonance for me and for a lot of people where it's like you watch him, especially on the good nights, and here's this 6'10 dude with broad shoulders that nobody can deal with on drives. And then you send double teams to him and he's making all these passes, which, funny enough, quietly, the Magic 6-3 in their last 9 games. And the playmaking from Paolo Banchero has been very good over this stretch of games. So I want to sprinkle that in. But like you see him on those nights, it's like, holy crap, what do we do? Or you go back to the playoff appearances that the Magic haven't won yet, but it's like, oh, well, Paolo has the mid-range jumper going in these series. Smaller sample size, but if he's got the midi going and he's driving into the free throw line and he's making plays, this is the offensive engine that the Magic envision. But then you watch him on other nights and it's, why did Paolo take this shot? Why did Paolo catch and hold here? What are these turnovers? Why did he pass up this look? What are the screens looking like? hey, he kind of fell asleep a little bit defensively. We'll say overall, like, I appreciate like the off-ball defense from Paolo, some of the rim protection, but you do still have those moments like, okay, who is he guarding? Those kind of things. And then you zoom out, and this is yet another year where Paolo has solid box score stuff. 22 a night, career high 8.5 rebounds, 5 assists, nearly a steal on the block. And the Magic have once again been outscored in his minutes. And this has been something that has been consistent pretty much his entire career. Just so far this year, over 1,600 minutes for Paolo on the floor. Pretty much net neutral, but it's a minus 0.5 net rating in those minutes. With Paolo off the floor, it's a plus 2.1 in over 1,100 minutes. For Paolo's career, minus 1.5 net rating in nearly 9,000 minutes. That includes regular season, that includes playoffs, etc. With him off the floor, it's a plus 2.1. So they're about 3, maybe 4 points better without Paolo on the floor. Or they have outscored opponents without Paolo on the floor. That becomes a louder conversation when you juxtapose that with the Franz Wagner experience. You look at what that has been across the career. Paolo on the floor without Franz, minus 5.5 net rating in over 3,800 minutes. Franz without Paolo is nearly a plus 6 per 100 possessions in over 3,200 minutes. And so it just kind of takes me to, Paolo is very obviously good, but there are also very obvious growth areas for him. The roster context, especially if we're broadening it out throughout his whole career, hasn't always been ideal for him. But because of the player archetype he is, it doesn't always make it easy to fit in a bunch of different player types to make those kind of things work. And so now it's just like, I want to have this conversation with you because I know we can have a normal conversation about Paolo to where we can acknowledge this is where he's good. Also, this is where he hurts. And I'm just in a weird place with the Paolo experience. And it feels like the conversation around him has gotten louder in light of Orlando having this weird injury riddled role shifting season.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's pause right there, because I think there are a couple things that have happened here. One, I'll set it up with this. So when we talk about polarizing players, I personally struggle with that because I feel like it's the conversation that is polarizing and not necessarily the player. I think there's like there's strengths and weaknesses in all basketball players. I personally believe basketball is art. It's not science. It's not math. There's highs, there's lows. There's things you got to figure out. There's ways you can get better and improve. There's different things that you can kind of enhance, like fit, opportunity, context can change a player. You can think about a player one way with one team looks different in another team because he has to do something completely different. Like there's just a lot that goes into the pot. But I think the problem with the Paolo conversation is a lot has gone into the pot and we're just kind of submerging a whole lot of things and it's gotten real loud because the quote unquote bad Paolo experience is loud for people. If you're not a fan of mid-range jump shots or catch and holds or one-on-one attacks, you're going to watch Paolo take some of those shots, miss, and be like, see, this is what he does. And you're not necessarily going to see some of the times where, okay, he gets to pass and cut action, pitch action. He makes a couple dribbles, draws defense, makes a kick. He made it the right read. He made the right play. The Magic didn't make a shot. We're not necessarily giving Paolo credit for that. I think it also converges with the Franz Wagner deal where it's like, okay, we're not just kind of talking about them as a duo. We're doing the Jason Tatum and Jalen thing. It's they're not good as the Celtics were. So we're just kind of saying Franz is better and we're leaving it there. So now we're having a conversation about Paolo, the archetype, right? And now we're having who's the better Magic player. And then the Magic aren't winning. And now Franz hasn't been on the court when the Magic aren't winning. And we have the subtext of when Paolo was out, Franz and the Magic were winning a little bit or Franz performing well. And we're putting that all in one big pot. I don't know if we have to do that. For me with Paolo, it's been about quick decisions for him. When he makes quick decisions, he generally has a good outcome. You know, you can get mad, like he's one of the strongest drivers we've seen. Like his, I'm going to put my head down, you're coming with me, tight finishes. That's not an easy thing to do. His ability to attack matchups is something that will enhance them in the playoffs if they were in a better position, in my eyes. I think I had Orlando as a dark horse because, okay, you're going to have to defend Paolo and Franz with some people you don't necessarily want to put on them. The three-point shot has been what it is. So you're basically you're hoping the drives hit and you're hoping the mid-range hits. And depending on how you feel about mid-range jumpers or the self-creation of those jumpers, it doesn't always feel great. In the Orlando context, offensively has slipped as the season has gone on to where we've seen the highs of it, but we haven't seen the highs from it in a minute. Not to say that they can't score the basketball. It just has not felt like it did early in the season. And some of that you can, like, I don't think Paolo is blameless within this, but I think every, I don't want to, what's the word? What's a word below star, Nikaias? Every really good player has their process, has their way of going about things, right? They have their gathers, mm-hmm. their hesitations, their setups. And, you know, I mean, even you go back to that Houston-Orlando game, Kevin Durant has his setups. It worked, because but it took him about four times to get you in position to get to the reject. You know, that's just kind of what it is. But how much do we give Paolo credit when, okay, I'm bringing the ball up, I'm trying to get to the point, the defense helps on my drive at the nail, now I kick, we're not making shots. Like, if you go back to that Houston-Orlando game, you watch that first quarter, Paolo's kicking the ball with regularity. So, okay, I can draw attention, I can make the right read. We're not making shots. Okay, I need to get a shot up. It's just a balance deal. But he's in the position, and the conversation has gotten so loud that what he does poorly, or what he struggles with, I should say, is louder mm-hmm. to people. And you're mm-hmm. just kind of stuck there, especially if you don't see the magic, but every so often, or you're looking at a box score and you're saying, oh, here goes Paolo, 8 for 22 again. Well, how did he get to 22 shots? What did the 8 look like? You know?
Mm-hmm. No, I'm with you. Like, I think to your point, I agree that some of it goes too far. Like, when you get into, again, not saying this is like super widespread, but if you get into like Paolo's metrics, again, if you get into like EPM, and if you look at like what is this efficiency based, you know, compared to league average, stuff like that, like, yes, it could be underwhelming when you consider like what his stature in the offense is, what the contract commitment is, et cetera. And I think there is like valid conversation to be had around if this is going to be the franchise guy for you. Between him and Franz, of course. But, like, if he's going to be your number one, if he's going to be your highest paid player, if this is who we're building the boat around, if you're going to have this many touches within an offense, there is just a baseline level of you have to make, to your point, quick decisions. But ultimately, you have to make good decisions with the ball. If you are taking a lot of shots, there is just, like, a baseline level of efficiency that you need to hit to make that worth it, both on the court producing wins, but within a team building construct, you are a big salary slot, too. And so, like, we have to get a certain level of quote-unquote value out of this salary slot, because it is now tougher to build really good teams in light of the aprons and whatever's about to happen with the lottery and stuff, and how that may impact, you know, trade logic across the league and things like that. So it's like, oh, it's super important now as Paolo now transitioning from rookie scale contract to max. If you're number one, you have to produce like a number one, not to, you know, parody a former number one pick in the NFL.
What are you?
But like, you got,
what are you talking about? You talking about, you keep on here talking about cookies? No.
I love cookies. No. But there's just like a baseline level there. So, like, I think that part is fair. I don't think if Paolo underperforms certain baselines, that automatically mean he's bad. Like, I would like some of this conversation to be reframed. To your point, again, it's getting loud. You're mixing in a whole bunch of different stuff. But, like, I do think it's worth having bigger picture conversations about, like, what this means if Paolo doesn't hit X consistently. And I think what makes it tougher to guard, or tougher to kind of sort through if you're in the Magic front office, or even if you're a Magic fan, is that if Paolo just was never a high-impact guy at any stretch, for any, like, conceivable stretch, then it'd be easy to be like, all right, it's time to cut bait, let's trade him, yada, yada, we're resetting the wheel, we're building around Franz and Bane and Jalen Suggs, and we go from there. The fact that we have seen like extended stretches of Paolo dominant driver, good playmaker, mismatch hunter, he unlocks things for us, he can save possessions for us with late clock shot making or foul drawing. So the fact that we've seen is like, please bottle this so we don't have to talk about or wonder or worry about this anymore. And so it's just kind of like bridging the gap between like, how do we get a more consistent version of the good Paolo, the quick decision-making Paolo, even the shot-making Paolo to that end? Because like, I don't think, you know, we talk about it all the time across the history of the show. Like, do I think mid-range jumpers are inherently bad? No. If you're comparing them to rim shots and threes, like, there's a hierarchy for me. But if you're making enough of the mid-range shots, I love Shea. He takes a ton of middies. You know what I mean? But he's one of the best mid-range scorers in the league. Kevin Durant, same thing. Like, I appreciate that. If you are taking a bunch of them and also not making them, that's where I'm just like, hey, how can we refine this? Is this taking more threes? Is this being more intentional about getting to the rim? Which, to Paolo's credit, this is the highest share of shots at the rim that he's had in his career this year. Like, he deserves credit for that, even within this context. And he's still converting a pretty high share of shots at the rim on top of that. But like, okay, where's the refinement coming from? And again, to your earlier point, Steve, and I'll toss the mic to you. Like, how much of this is Paolo just has to get better at XYZ? versus this context does not set him up to be the best version of himself consistently? And like, how do you marry the two?
I just think when you think about players, sometimes the shots they take is to either set up or have a counterbalance to what they do very well, right? And so I think Paolo is driving the basketball. I think he also knows, boy, I need some of these mid-range jump shots to go so I can make my drive a little bit easier. So I don't have to now do an in and out when I get past half court and try and put my head down and have a shoulder in your chest at the free throw line every single time. If you're going to give me this gap, maybe I can just get a quick 1-2 dribble pull up, get 2 points on the board, and then, okay, now I can set you up with a fake, and now I can kind of lead the dance a little bit. We've seen players with this kind of archetype kind of dabble with that. You know, everyone used to yell at Giannis for mid-range jump shots and the type of ones he took. Took him a long time to figure it out. But boy, once he figured it out, how much fun did you have? And so there's growing pains. And I understand people talk about the value. These guys earn their way to certain status with teams by their play. And yes, that comes with a standard. It also comes with responsibility. It also comes with teams saying, hey, buddy, no, not you. We're going, all these things you do well, we're not going to allow you to do them well. And so I think for me, I don't necessarily yell at people who are like, well, Paolo is this, this, and that. But I'm like, okay, can we at least consider the fact that he does have talent? He may have shortcomings. Can we marry the two a little bit better than we do? It doesn't have to just be black. Like, it's not black and white. This stuff is gray. And so it's on Paolo to kind of make some of these improvements and make quick decisions. And, you know, maybe it's back getting him back to movement across the board. You know, how much time does he get pick and roll in different areas of the floor, lower on the court, empty side, you know, handoffs, pass and cut? Does he kind of have that movement? Or is it like, hey, Paolo, attack and transition. Hey, make a play late in the clock. Hey, run pick and roll. What does that balance look like? Is that the opening he needs? Does he need more shooting? Does he need a better big to play with? Does he need, you know, there's a lot of different things where it's like, could this look different if we just kind of enhance this? Or Paolo, so we're going to build around that. And now, hey, he's not making those shots anymore. This doesn't look as good. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But I think he's a really good basketball player. Potential to be better. Don't let this turn into the offensive Rudy Gobert conversation, please. Please. whatever debates you're having, please just settle them. Shake hands and let's not do the tennis match. Please. I don't need an offensive version of that.
Well, you see, Steve, it's already starting. If you haven't seen the graphic of like what Paolo's last 7 or 8 games or something like that, to where he's shooting well over 40% from three. But he's also shoot like it's like on one hand it's like, hey, Paolo's starting to knock jumpers now, what you got to say now? And then it's like, well, if you're hitting this amount of threes and your field goal percentage is still this, then like, why is it that it's there, Steve?
Can I make a quick comment?
Sure.
I think people have too much information. I think there's too many numbers out there. I think you can find any sort of a number to back up what you think, and now you're just stuck with, hey, I got evidence. And it's like, well, so do they. So now what are y'all doing? Y'all just exchanging graphs and pictures and box scores? Like, what are we? It's a lot. It's a lot for Elmo.
It's a lot for Elmo. I guess quickly to bounce off of that, Steve, because I do think we are, as a basketball community, I think we are spoiled with the level of information that we have now and the amount of access that we have now. And I don't think it is inherently bad to have more information and more stats. And I say this as someone that I'll cite on off, I'll cite, like, I'm more of a tracking data person than like an actual advanced metric person. I always try to make that designation because, like, this is what I am. Like, you asked me to explain, this is why I'll use EPM. I'm not using LeBron or something else, but I'm just like, I need to learn more about that before I'm like actively using that in my analysis, that kind of thing. I think to your overall point, there is a level of responsibility you should have when you are using these, and there's a level of understanding that you should have when using these, and this should be married with what you are watching. It's something that you say all the time. You know, when I was asking you before we started this pod, like, hey, I want to get better at learning about X, Y, Z, whatever. One of the first things you told me, and something that you've told others with SBC and on this pod, et cetera, when we get mailbag questions, hey, take notes, come in with an open mind. If you enter a game saying, I think the example you use all the time is like Andre Drummond. going back to like the Cavs and the stuff. It's like, hey, if you go in saying Andre Drummond can't defend, when you watch him, you are already predisposed to pointing out whatever the mistakes are going to be with him. Come in open and then build out your base from there. And I think it's a similar bit with using numbers, whatever they may be. It could be as simple as box score stuff. This guy shoots 45% from the field. Why does he do that? Versus, he shoots 45% from the field. It must be bad. You turn on the clip and see him miss a jumper. It's like, yep, there it is. There's the proof. Like, see what sticks. Look at the numbers. If that matches, that makes sense. If it doesn't, that should open up. This feels different than what I've seen. Let me investigate this further to see why this may be the bit. Versus, we're going to throw this in blindly or we're going to throw this out blindly. Like, I think there's just room for balance in this. I like information. I like numbers. So it's just like, understand what they are. It makes sure you are complementing that with not just film, but like understanding of film. So that's also the thing that's kind of, I know that spooks you too, scares me, where it's like, this player is bad at defense. Here's why. I got a clip. You look at the clip and it's like, well, actually, this just was not his responsibility whatsoever, or was not her responsibility whatsoever. So like, I see the point you're trying to make, but like, this actually isn't what they were supposed to be doing here. So like, I don't think you can use that. But that can turn into a whole 20-minute segment. I wanted to bring the Paolo thing to you because we're
That's a different podcast. We can do a different podcast on that one. I'm glad we did the Paolo thing. We'll do Reed Shepherd next week. I only have one request before we go to break, okay. Right? Rockets fans, please stop doing the same tweets all the time. Please, please. Reed Shepherd is a good basketball player. He's gotten some very valuable reps. When Houston gets teams in rotation, he's even more dangerous. He's really good when teams are in a plane drop against him. When they decide to switch, it can get tricky. Teams are going to attack him on the other end. Ime Udoka loves him. He mumbles and curses out everyone else except for Reed Shepherd, and just let it be. All right, it's gonna probably work out. It's my rant.
Okay, I like the quick rant and also the tease on Reed Shepherd thoughts. We will get into those maybe next week, but soon. We'll just say soon because that gives us a little bit of range to kind of plan this thing out. But we're gonna take a break here. When we return, we're gonna talk a little Unrivaled.
Maybe we'll dunk tape it. Who knows?
And we are back with this episode of the Dunker Spot. And Steve, it is time to talk Unrivaled. As we record on this Friday morning, last day of the regular season is today on Friday. First pair of games at 1 Eastern, 2:15. And you have late games at 7:30 and 8:45, I believe. We'll officially get the playoff seedings. We already know what the 6 playoff teams are, but the seeding is going to be finalized with matchups tonight. So we'll be keeping tabs on those. Want to talk a little bit more award stuff. On the last episode of the Dunker Spot, had a little bit of an MVP conversation. I told Steve and told the Dunkers, hey, I was kind of leaning Aaliyah Boston here. I had to submit my official ballot by 5 p.m. Eastern on Tuesday. And so I was going between her and, okay, am I solidified on Aaliyah Boston versus Kelsey Plum? Am I solidified with Breanna Stewart versus Alicia Gray? Like, what am I going to do with Chelsea Gray? Because she's been phenomenal, but the record, what I do with Paige, yada, yada. So we're going through all that stuff. And as I said, towards the end of that conversation, I'm leaning towards Aaliyah Boston. I then ended up having Aaliyah Boston as my MVP. So that vote is revealed. I did write an article explaining my picks on Yahoo Sports. So you can check that out if you want the full description. But Steve wanted to get your live reaction to my picks and my reasoning. So Aaliyah Boston ended up being MVP for me. I have Breanna Stewart 2. I have Chelsea Gray 3. Any loud complaints about the winner choice or the ballot order?
No loud complaints. One day we will get you to say the hashtag MV Plum. That will not happen this year, but one day we will. It will happen. It will occur. It's my life's work. It's my legacy on the line. I will say, who was 4 for you? What was there any difficulty? Did you get there with Brittany Sykes? Was there an outlier that was just like, ooh, maybe, but ultimately I'm staying here?
Yeah, I think one just kind of set the table for people that may not be familiar. So with the MVP ballot with Unrivaled, it is just a top 3 compared to like a top 5 with the W or a top 5 with the NBA. So you only get 3. But as I was thinking through it, and as I ultimately wrote a little blurb about it towards the end of the piece talking about the all Unrivaled teams that are going to get there. Steve and I have had this conversation quite a few times to where when it comes to MVP, like I am placing a higher emphasis on the winning and like how you're winning, like winning games, winning your minutes, et cetera. I'm putting a higher emphasis on that for MVP versus like just your all league or your all W, your all NBA, et cetera. And so I think for this, like I probably would have had Brittany Sykes fourth for what she meant to the Laces on both ends of the floor, took on tough defensive assignments, had big stops, was their most consistent offensive player. Many of huge third and fourth quarters for the Laces to help win those games. And they are, again, towards the top of the standings. I think they are the three seed heading into today's action. If they win and if the Mists lose and they get to two seed and they get their first round bye, so we wouldn't get to see them until Monday. So I think Brittany Sykes would probably be fourth on my ballot. And then fifth is where it gets interesting. Like my fictional top five would have been Aaliyah Boston, Breanna Stewart, Chelsea Gray, Brittany Sykes, and I think I would have went Paige, because generally with MVP it's like, hey, your MVP candidate should be the top player on your team. Like, I don't love getting into teammates being in the top five, that kind of thing. So like, I am picking one kind of thing, and so I would have went Sykes four, Paige five on that front.
Understood. I think I get when people separate the idea of, hey, this is the MVP because of impact and winning, and these are people who perform very well. But for me, if you're telling me these are the top three, it should be also the top three on the other side. If this is your top five, mm-hmm. this should also be your top five. That to me is just like, okay, you've said these are the five best in the world. That's your first team in my opinion. So that's always where I'm at. Mm-hmm. I'm interested to hear where you went with the other awards, because we kind of dabbled and talked about MVP in the last episode, and I was kind of expecting this from you, but where did you pivot to elsewhere?
D-Boy is tough because, like, one, you do just have a lot of different performances. And if you're comparing Unrivaled to like a W season, or if you just broaden the scope for like NBA stuff as well, like 3-on-3 is just different from 5-on-5. Like, the types of coverages that you can deploy, I think we certainly saw the limit stretch this year for a few teams. We're going to get there when we get to Coach of the Year. But, like, you just have to evaluate it in a different way. And, like, you don't have the same access to, like, pick and roll defense numbers and stuff in Unrivaled like you would for like the W in the NBA. Or at least if you're not on a staff, you wouldn't have that. So like, you know, if one of the assistants want to slide you that, then by all means. and so it's just like, okay, this is a lot of eye, this is a lot of box score, and this is a lot of like asking around, like, hey, like one of the things that I did, and I think I said so on the Tuesday show, is like I'm asking around and want to talk to some people, kind of bounce some names. Like, I have my own list. I don't necessarily want to be like, hey, insert personnel person here, or coach here, or other voter here. Give me your winner so I can also have that winner. Like, I have my own train of thought, but the way that I frame these conversations was like, hey, these are the group of names that I'm considering. Do you feel like I should be adding someone else to consider stronger, more strongly? Or is there someone that you just would not have? And kind of balance that with what I've seen, the numbers that I do have access to, those kind of things. And so on one hand, it made me feel good that, like, okay, the range of players that I was considering for DPOY and these other awards, the people that I talked to were also thinking about those players. I'm like, okay, at least I'm not going to have like an outlier at the very least. But like, I did put a real emphasis on being able to execute multiple things and unlocking a level of scheme versatility for your team. And so that's where I once again landed with Aaliyah Boston as my defensive player of the year winner. Like, with the traditional box score, averaging over two blocks, she's averaging a steal. She's the only player in the league averaging that, getting that, a steal and two blocks. But beyond that, like, her being able to be at the level when needed and executing that, her being able to be in a drop and being able to contest or turn those into late switches, her being able to switch outright and being able to hold up in space made it easier for Renika Hodges to be like, okay, cool, we can actually just operate with you and Kiki in the front court, or we can just go double big in general, because ultimately if they put you in action, I'm not worried about you. And if they don't put you in action, you are mobile enough, you have good enough instincts at the rim to where you can provide late help if necessary without burning the rest of our defense. And so her being able to execute that to that degree and to the level of consistency that she did, so that's where I landed with Aaliyah Boston one. From there, it was just like, ha, I don't know how I want to go about this, because there are so many good performances. And it's also like balancing, okay, who had the best defensive season versus like, who do I know is the best defender versus like, who gave good defense but didn't play enough. So this is where like, I have really enjoyed what Alyssa Thomas has done defensively this year. But like, she is outside the top 20 in minutes per game this year. And like, a lot of the Laces' success has been like, second half, hey, we're comfortable leaning on our bench we're fine with not having AT out here because this lineup is working, et cetera. So I think that's more team strength. But with an award like this, it's like, well, AT's defensive greatness is always going to be like the space that she takes away versus she is getting two steals a game or she's getting two blocks a game. So like the box score stuff was going to be there. And like even the scheme versatility goodness, she was very good at it and she helped unlock some stuff for them. But like the volume of seeing her do that was lower than some of the other candidates. So that's where she didn't land in the top three for me. But I think very firmly she is a top three defender in the league in a vacuum. And then like even thinking about someone like Saniya Rivers, who I think on a per minute basis, she might have just been the best defender in the league this year. But missed a couple of games. The trade doesn't really matter too much. But like missing games, like the low minute counts, like, well, okay, I can't really argue her over some of these others because she's not playing as much as these other players, but like she was very good. So she was someone I thought about looking at the miss. Like Breonna Stewart ended up on my ballot, but it's not like Alicia Gray didn't have a really good defensive season. It's not like Veronica Burton didn't have a really good defensive season.
That's the name I was going to bring up. So I'm glad you did it. Veronica. So I'll ask my question now, because how did you balance? You know, I think it's easier. It's 3-on-3. So people are going to get cooked at some point, inevitably. So I think it's easier to sometimes give credit to bigs because they're being asked to do different things. It's not easy for guards in Unrivaled to defend, because you got to defend 1-on-1. You got to try and navigate screens. There's not a ton of space. You got to get back in front quick. So it's like, okay, how do we appreciate the year that Veronica Burton had? Because I thought her defense was excellent for the most part. But how do guards play into this as opposed to the bigs being bigs?
I think I had a tough time. This is where like my top three ended up being pretty large. Like Aaliyah Boston, she's a traditional big. She was my winner. Breonna Stewart was also on my ballot. Like plays big, but like more forward and could just do a lot of different stuff. The other name that I had on my ballot was Ryan Howard, who technically in the perimeter camp, but like she's a legit 6'2". And so like you have the navigation stuff from her, but there's also the switchability. There's also, so there's a good offensive player on their side, but Ryan, we're going to put you on their worst offensive player so you could just muck stuff up. And like, I really put an emphasis on, because of this 3-on-3 format and how much more space there is to cover, players that can be deployed in a way to take away space versus like take away specific matchups. Not that the latter doesn't have value, but like, I think I put a bigger emphasis on, okay, who can disrupt space? Who can disrupt what teams are trying to open up schematically more than who are your best 1-on-1 defenders? And I think broadly speaking, where your guards like Veronica Burton or even Brittany Sykes were bringing up another guard, like I think that's probably where they end up a little bit lower for me. Less because they weren't doing good stuff, but more like I was prioritizing something else to a higher degree. And so like I could take the step back as we talk about this, like, is that the right way to go about it? I don't know. Like I'm always going to be refining what my thought process is. I want to have my core tenets, but I have room to kind of like, okay, maybe I should factor this higher moving forward. But that is the way that I kind of thought about it. Like, again, Aaliyah being able to...
Basketball... I was going to say basketball is subjective. So, I mean, if you value certain things, that's going to go into your input voting-wise. My thing is just like, don't forget, that's not easy either. The teams that are not in the playoffs kind of had guard play where it was hard for them to get back in front. The best teams looked real good in pick and roll and handoffs because, well, we can just make you make a quick decision and we can get what we want. So it's like, okay, do we value being able to pressure and navigate and get back in front and deal with that in this format? That's all. Not a right or wrong. Just thought.
I don't know. That's fair. I think even to your point, like Aaliyah Boston's my winner. To your navigation point, when they go to Natasha Cloud plus Kiki plus Aaliyah Boston, like having Natasha Cloud being, you know, one, she can guard a little bit of everybody, so you can just switch a whole bunch of stuff. But like having someone that can navigate screens like that certainly makes life easier to that end. Even though I had Stewie on my ballot, but having Veronica Burton and Alicia Gray, that makes it a little bit easier for her to play the cat and mouse when they ask her to do more aggressive things in pick and roll. And so like, even so, that's where you look at the Stewie box score in particular. Like this wasn't a 1.5 steals, 1.5 block year. We know she has the talent to do so. Part of that number being lower is because, okay, well, I don't have to drastically save these kind of possessions. But again, I value, oh, you don't even have the opening to put yourself in position to have these kind of rim attempts to where Stewie has to fly in. Oh, she could just be on insert non-shooter here. And like, we're just mucking that up. You're not having fun. So like, that's kind of where I went with my voting there. I guess aside from Veronica Burton, is there any other defender that either we haven't talked about yet or someone else that you want to give love to? Or
No, you nailed Natasha Cloud. I thought Jackie Young had some aggressive moments. I wanted to give the salute to the guards. That was all.
Okay, understood. Okay, so as we now flow to, we'll go Coach of the Year, and then we'll get into the all-unrival teams. I'm sure that's where a lot of conversation is going to come in. But with Coach of the Year, I went with Renika Hodges, head coach of the Phantom. Like, naturally, very talented group. But you got one combined game from Satu Sabli, who is, I think, still recovering from the concussion. Nice to see her around unrivaled at the very least. So hopefully she is feeling better. But no Satu Sabli this year. You got one game out of Dana Evans, and she was just on the injury report, and it's like, huh, it's odd. I've seen her, like, scrimmaging before. We just have not seen her this year. And so, like, you do have a little bit of injury adversity there. But for me, it was naturally the fans are having the best record in the league heading into today's action. But, like, the way that she deployed these players this year on both ends of the floor was a lot of fun for me. It was very obviously effective, as we've seen them on this, like, 6-game win streak to where they can hum on both ends of the floor. But, like, there was never a steady dose of anything on both ends of the floor. And I think that's probably the biggest compliment I could play, in addition to her helping establish this baseline level of, we are going to be physical, we are going to be competitive, you are not going to have any time. You're not going to be able to breathe against us on either end. If you're on defense, you got to worry about these screens. You got to worry about these seals. We may dump it down to that. We may go, like, horns adjacent, and then you don't know if this is going to be a quick pitch into a two-player action. You don't know if this is going to be a dive from the other person at the elbow for a quick post-up. We can just flow into a whole bunch of stuff. Pick and roll can be traditional. We may have a lift. We may have a late dive. This may be a double drag. There was just so much stuff within this offense. And when you add in the lineup versatility on top of that, it's just like, hey, this is a very well-coached team that also plays hard all the gosh darn time. And I just really appreciated that from the Phantom this year. So that's where Renika Hodges got the number one vote from me. Two and three got tough because I felt like it was like four or five coaches for those last two spots. And so I ended up with Andrew Wade, head coach of the Laces, and I ended up with Noel Quinn, head coach of the Breeze. But I looked at it, so like, I can make cases for all of them because that's ultimately my ballot. But it's just like, man, Zach O'Brien just got here with the Mist. And, like, yes, there's a lot of defensive talent and stuff and having Stewie's. But, like, he did such a good job with the defense in particular. Because you may have the personnel to do a lot of different stuff and kind of mix matchups and stuff like that. But you still have to do that. You still have to teach it in a way. Like, first game of the year, I'm asking him, like, hey, man, this volume of peel switching is kind of crazy. Y'all able to kind of shut down. I think it was the Hive in their opening matchups. Like, hey, this is kind of nasty. Like, those kind of concepts, like, they're more prevalent in Unrivaled, but, like, that's not an easy thing to nail. It's not an easy thing to teach and also just have that as part of your base instantly. You know what I mean? So, like, I want to give them credit for that. But then, like, I look at this Breeze team. It's just like, I think I wrote, what, four of their six players before we get to the Courtney Williams trade, but, like, four of their six players are new to Unrivaled. They are the youngest roster in the league. You deal with injury and, like, other absences. And, again, like, very glad that Rekia Jackson is back. But, like, you have that kind of thing. And Noel also able to implement, we can move Paige on and off the ball. We can use our bigs in different ways. We can use them as hubs. We can shift up what our space is going to be offensively. Defensively, we can throw out different looks. And, like, bringing that young group along, like, that's not an easy thing to do. Andrew Wade, as he's navigating all of these different lineups. And the defense, like, very impressed with how aggressive they were able to get. Like, some of that is personnel, naturally. It's easier to be aggressive when you have Alyssa Thomas, for example, or when you have guards like Brittany Sykes, Jackie Young. But, again, deploying that isn't an easy thing to do. Leaning on the bench in some of those closed lineups and being willing to deploy different lineups and not have ego kind of take over, it's a testament to the character of the roster, but also you kind of have to have guts to pull that off when you have some of the names that you have. So, like, I want to respect that as well. So I ended up with Hodges, Wade, Quinn as my top three, but Zach O'Brien certainly had a case. Nola Henry dealing with all the injuries he had to deal with. And, again, the Chelsea Gray season overall, like, I could have made a case for Nola. So, like, it's not easy to parse. It's never easy to parse through Coach of the Year, as people that have been listening to this podcast know when we talk about the NBA or the W. But, yeah, that was the top three I landed at. Honorable mention to Zach O'Brien. That's where I was at.
You said Zach O'Brien's name twice. Give me your all-unrivaled teams.
Okay. On the first team, Steve, you'll be proud. My top three remains my top three. We got Aaliyah Boston. We got Chelsea Gray. We got Breanna Stewart. The second team, we got Kelsey Plum. We got Alicia Gray. We got Paige Beckers.
Okay.
And so I felt, as we talked about at the top, valuing something for MVP versus all league teams, like I think Paige was better than Brittany Sykes this year.
Okay.
I think Paige had more offensive responsibility overall. And you talk about the coverage scene between those two. Like Paige also got a pretty steady dose of two on the ball, not just in pick and roll, but even with some of the off-ball stuff. Early physicality, and then we have to have our big up because a Paige comes off, she's pulling up or she's making playmaking reads from there. And so, like, that's where I kind of split hairs between her and Brittany Sykes. Like, I think you can very easily have Brittany there because of what she did on both ends. And again, this Lakers team won quite a bit. But, like, that would be my one shift there. But those okay. were the six for me.
Okay. I understand. That was my main question. But let's see if I can go with a little bit of a curveball here. Did you give any consideration, because I know you had Ryan Howard for DPOY. Did you give any consideration to the Bucket Getters? Any thought about Marina Mabry or Aaliyah Edwards or maybe even a Jackie Young, a Kalia Copper even?
I would say, like, I did directly list Marina and Aaliyah as part of the honorable mentions group. I think Marina, as much as, like, early on the season was like, hey, man, last possession of the second quarter, why are you taking this early shot when you can just milk the clock? It's like, what's going on here? But I will say, in all seriousness, the bucket getting from Marina was very impressive. Obviously, the high point was the historic 47-point performance, the 27-point quarter in Philadelphia. There's your high water mark. But I think overall this year, it was fun watching her go from, okay, they're kind of putting two on the ball against me. Sometimes they're not, like, trying to navigate what teams are throwing at her defensively. Like, the turnovers were super high to start the year. And then it went on just like, okay, we're just manipulating this. Here's a reject. Sometimes I don't need a screen. I can still get to my spot. I know this coverage is coming. I can now take another side dribble to my right, string this along, and now that's going to open up a bounce pass to Aaliyah Edwards. So, like, watching the playmaking growth, you know, over the course of the year was fun in addition to the bucket getting. So, like, she was someone I considered, similar to Aaliyah Edwards. Like, it's not easy to have that much of a volume jump from year one to year two. And this is with her, like, she was also, like, banged up in the year. It wasn't like she missed, like, five games, but, like, she wasn't playing at 100% in some of those games. And still, driving all over the place, the post seals were there. What, top five, top six in scoring, leading rebounder in the league. I think led the league or was tied for the league in double doubles this year. Like, she was very good. So, like, she was also someone I considered. But, like, that top six, and really the top seven, when you also factor in Brittany Sykes, like, that did feel like the group. And then we got other players. Like, some other names I at least thought about. Like, you mentioned Jackie Young. Like, she was also someone I considered. The Veronica Burton piece was interesting to me. De'Erica Hamby's another name I also want to say. She was also very good. And you really felt on the nights that she didn't have it offensively or teams were, like, more physical with her and could disrupt her at the rim. You felt that on those nights with the vinyl. We talked about the vinyl's offense this year. So I want to say De'Erica Hamby's names too. But, like, I thought a little bit more about Veronica Burton. I was like, man, if she scored more or scored more efficiently, like, everything else, really good guard, rebounder, the playmaking was there. Obviously, the defense was there. If there was more scoring, like, I think there really would have been a stealth case for her for one of these. Or at the very least, it would have been, like, a firm honorable mention for me. So I could say this on the pod without having to add the word count in the article at the very least. But that was another name that I was thinking about. And some of the newcomers as well. We can get there. Is there anyone else you would toss in aside from the bucket getters?
No. Maybe Kelsey Mitchell, maybe Monique Billings, but it's tough. It's hard. It's a hard league, and there's only three spots per team. So even your hypothetical third and fourth team, you'd have some snubs. So it's not an easy thing, but you did a great job, Nikias. So everyone, salute Nikias. Job well done. I know you felt like you had to explain it, but you did a great job, man. I got no complaints. Two thumbs up. Well done.
I appreciate you, big dog. Last couple, like, questions that I have for you, or questions/thoughts that I have before we get out of here. So, because I was just thinking a lot about award stuff, and again, the article is out if you want to read that full thing, I was like, huh, what if some other awards existed? Even in the traditional
sense.
I want to toss out some awards. Yeah, so I want to toss out some awards and some names for consideration. Doesn't necessarily have to be a winner unless you feel strongly about someone, but... Not going to take long. So if we had an unrivaled rookie of the year, I would imagine that would be between Paige Bueckers and Kelsey Plum. Would you just be going Plum in that regard?
Well, Plum would have been my MVP, so Paige would have got that award.
Okay, so now I have to pause the podcast. Okay, so if Plumlee's your MVP, you were acknowledging that she's had a better season than Paige, who was also in her first year on Unrivaled. How would Paige have the Rookie of the Year in
value?
If she's valuable enough for MVP, why would she not be the Rookie of the Year?
Because she won MVP.
Okay. Don't you know, we'll, next question. For the interest of time, I'll be okay. all right. So Unrivaled Most Improved Player, which I'm sure that would have you in a headlock this year. Would that just be Analia between Boston or Edwards? Or would you, who else would you have in consideration there?
That sounds fine. That sounds fine. Okay. I'm fine with Ali Edwards for that. I have no issue there.
Okay. I was thinking, I was like, huh, this the Boston, the vinyl season last year, was like, it was fine, but there were some points where it was like, I don't know if this is the format for her. And then she's had an MVP run. So there you go. I thought you were going to be very loud on like the Ray Burrell kick.
Nah, so different word for that. Spark plug of the year. Spark most underrated. Most undervalued. Respect Ray Burrell. Mm.
Okay. Respect Burrell. And who would be the unrivaled clutch player of the year for you? And I asked this specifically because so you're looking at the leaderboard of who has like the most winning baskets when you get that target score. It's like five players tied for first on that list. So who would be your who would be your unrivaled clutch player of the year if they had one? That'd be
nice thing to hear. I feel like I would just say kind of say Chelsea Gray. Between like Chelsea, KP, and Arike, and I don't, maybe I just give it to Arike.
Oh, okay. Give the miss some love. I respect.
Nah, okay. The miss have like two people on the board. They have two people on the board, so I'm gonna go Chelsea Gray. Never mind.
Okay. All right. There you go. There you go. And just a general salute to Don Malanga for giving us a pair of dunks this year. Like, we appreciate it. And there's still time for more. So we will see what today holds and what the playoffs ultimately hold. But with that, thank you for listening to and or watching this episode of The Dunker Spot. Please subscribe if you haven't already. We're on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean. Wherever you get your podcast, you can find us. Subscribe to the Yahoo NBA YouTube channel if you haven't already. We've got pods. We've got new content on the channel as well. So check out the film room, hashtag dunk tape or whatever name you want to come across. We'll give y'all the weekend because someone has suggested dunk tape as the name of the breakdowns and we like it. So we're giving you the weekend. If you have other suggestions in the YouTube comments, maybe hashtag Dunker Film Room would have suggested on Twitter or Blue Sky or wherever. Get those in because if we don't get anything better than that, that might just be it. We like it. So just be on the lookout for that and for more of those in general. You can follow me on socials at KaisNBA. You can follow Steve on socials at Steve Jones 20. And with that, we will catch y'all next week.